Good afternoon, everyone. Allison Skaberg here with Consolidated Planning Group, and we are here today to bring another webinar to you, an educational webinar for families with loved ones with differing abilities. And today we have Tessa Conaway here with us, and she's going to kind of talk to us about the ABA services from U of H Center for Autism and Developmental Disabilities, and kind of the who, what, where, when, why, all the details about that. So we're glad you're here. I always like to go over a few housekeeping items from the beginning. We are in webinar mode today, and what that means is we can't see you or hear you, and we, you know, sometimes have people joining us from a podcast. So if you're listening to this later on a podcast and you would like a copy of these slides, you can certainly just email us at contact@cpgcares.net and we will be happy to send you a copy of today's slides. Everybody who is registered for this webinar today is going to get a copy of the slides as well as a link to the recording after the fact because we are recording this today. So as always, we invite you to put your questions through in the chat box, and I'll be monitoring that chat box throughout the presentation, and we'll present those questions to Tessa. We'll answer just as many of them as we can. Today, we are just going for an hour, so 12 to 1 today. So if you're planning your lunch or planning the rest of your afternoon, you can plan around that. So Consolidated Planning Group, we are a holistic special needs financial planning firm. Some of you have attended our webinars in the past. We may have people that are here that have not attended in the past. Our whole firm is dedicated to working with families who have a loved one with a disability and help planning for them and their future. We put together protection plans, lifetime care plans. We do transition planning. We're nationally certified as Social Security advisors and members of the Special Needs Planning Academy. And a lot of what we do, people come to us and they say, how much do I need to fund the Special Needs Trust? Who's going to care for my loved one when I'm gone? How do we preserve eligibility for state and federally funded programs? When and how should we apply for things like SSI and Medicaid? And so we work with families on all of those things. So having said that, what I would like to do is I'd like to turn it over to Tessa, but I would first like to just thank the Galveston ISD and Kim Rogers and for being here today, and all of the families that have joined us today. I think you're in for a real treat. All right, thank you, Tessa. I'm gonna mute my audio and my video, and please tell us all about your program.
That's good, thank you for having me today. So my name is Tessa Conaway, and I am a BCBA, and I work at the Center for Autism and Developmental Disabilities at the University of Houston Clear Lake. So I do want to start by talking a little bit about what autism is. And if I could get, you can go ahead and put them all on the slide. Thank you. So there are three key criteria to getting an autism diagnosis. Those are going to be deficits in communication and social skills. We may see restricted or repetitive patterns of behaviors. So things like hand flapping is a common one that we see with individuals with autism. And these symptoms are often presenting themselves during early developmental period. So usually kids are getting diagnoses around ages 2 to 3. All of this together can cause significant impairments in one or more area of functioning. You'll hear me talk about that a lot today. We're not gonna work on things that are not impacting individuals' ability to function in the environment and improve their quality of life. So you may have heard some different terms. There used to be a number of diagnoses that have now all been grouped together as autism spectrum disorder. So you may have heard Asperger's, childhood disintegrative disorder, PDD-NOS, or Rett syndrome. These are all now grouped together as autism spectrum disorder. The spectrum is really important. We do see individuals with a range of skills and deficits on this. No two individuals with autism are going to be the same. So now the way to categorize it is based on three levels of severity, and we'll go through those levels of severity on the next slide. So the first level is requiring support. Individuals that have a level 1 diagnosis have difficulty with inflexibility, planning, switching between activities. That might look like a child who's participating in a general education classroom, but transitioning between different classes is challenging for them. We might also see deficits in social skills, difficulty initiating interactions or attempting to make friends. So maybe they respond when others approach them, but they have a hard time initiating those interactions. Level two would be requiring substantial support. This looks like difficulty with both verbal and nonverbal social communication skills, even with supports. So maybe if they have a one-on-one aide in a classroom, they're still having difficulty communicating their needs. They may also demonstrate repetitive behaviors and have difficulty changing activities and staying focused. So they may need that one-on-one support to remain engaged throughout the school day and on task. And then for level three, this is requiring very substantial support. For this one, we see severe deficits in social communication and very limited responses from social interaction. These individuals may not have a means to communicate their wants and needs at all. So maybe they don't have a functional form of communication. We also can see some inflexibility that can cause significant interference with the day-to-day activities. A lot of times with this, we may see more severe challenging behaviors like aggression towards themselves or aggression towards others. And these levels, this is flexible. It's a spectrum, as I said. So individuals may move forward and backward on this level system throughout their lifetime. So, like I said, we are a spectrum. So we do like to remember that no two individuals are going to be the same who have autism. So just to give you an example of what this might look like, we could have one individual who communicates with words. So maybe they're able to communicate their wants and needs with others. They have no problematic behaviors, so no aggression towards themselves, aggression towards others. Maybe we do see some hand flapping, but perhaps it doesn't interfere with their ability to participate in their classroom environment. And then on the other hand, we may have an individual who is nonverbal, so they don't have a way to communicate what they want and need with others. Maybe they do engage in self-injurious behavior, such as hitting themselves. They might not show any interest in interacting with others, and maybe they're in a special education classroom. We could work with both individuals. We're just going to tailor our treatment plan to those individuals' needs. So, what is behavior analysis? We are a scientific approach to the study of behavior, and we really emphasize the role of the environment. So, a little bit different from other branches of psychology, we are going to be looking at less of those internal states in a person's feelings and thoughts, and more of the effect of the environment on the behavior. There are two branches of behavior analysis. The first is experimental analysis of behavior. Within this, the goal is to identify the concepts of how the environment influences behavior to get a better understanding. Usually, this is done through animal research. And then, what you've probably heard of, if you've heard of behavior analysis, is applied behavior analysis. This is using those principles we identify within experimental analysis to apply them to socially significant areas of interest. So, for working with individuals with autism, we are looking at improving their quality of life using these techniques in an applied manner. And usually, that's done with humans. So I'm going to take you through some dimensions of different things that we aim to be as behavior analysts. The first one is we aim to be applied. So this looks at we are trying to create interventions to make meaningful changes in an individual's life. So we're really tailoring it based on that individual's needs and what's going to improve their quality of life. We also aim to be behavioral. Within that, like I mentioned, we're focused less on those internal states and more on behaviors that we can actually observe. So things like aggression towards others, lack of communication skills. We want things that are observable and clearly defined and measured. We also aim to be analytic, which means we use data. So we will collect data on the things that we're doing, the behaviors of interest. And we graph and visually analyze those data because we want to make sure what we're doing is actually causing behavior change. So if we're not seeing a change in the behavior, we're going to do something else. We also aim to be technological. This means that all of the procedures and behaviors we're targeting, we define in detail to make sure we are accurate in our implementation and our data collection. We also want to use this to make sure we are accurate in capturing the behaviors that are a concern in the natural environment. So we want to make sure if caregivers are reporting concern with aggression, that we know exactly what that looks like, so we are addressing the behavior that they are concerned with. We aim to be conceptually systematic, which means we are an evidence-based science. All of our interventions are research-based, and we are continually putting out new research to ensure that we are up to date and finding the best effective things to use. We aim to be effective. That doesn't mean we always are the first try, but we will use interventions and only continue them if we're seeing that behavior change. So, like I mentioned, we're collecting data to ensure that we are seeing the behavior change. If something we're doing isn't working, we're not going to keep trying that same thing. We'll make modifications until we find something that works for that child. We also aim for generality, which means we get the kiddos typically in the clinic setting. It doesn't matter if they can do the skills with us in the clinic, if they can't do it at home, if they can't do it in school. So we will practice with multiple people. We'll include other caregivers. We might do in-home sessions and school sessions to make sure the skills we're teaching are happening in all of the natural environments. So I'm going to take you through some common misconceptions about ABA. I know there's a lot of information out there that can be confusing or even a little bit scary. So we'll go through what some of those are. And one of them is that we teach learners robotic responses. So you may have heard that we are teaching individuals to say the same thing over and over again, kind of getting those robotic responses. We can program for, and we aim to program for, flexibility. So we can teach a variety of responses. If someone's greeting, I don't always say hi. When someone says hello to me, I might say, hey, how's it going? How are you today? So that we're teaching those flexible responses. We try to incorporate that in our programming. Another misconception is that we focus on behaviors and ignore feelings. It is really important for us to take into account the feelings of the individuals we're working with. If we have older individuals who maybe are able to express their feelings with us, we'll frequently check in with them and ask, how are you feeling about this? We get their opinion on the goals we're working on to make sure they're actually goals that are of interest to them and working towards their long-term goals for themselves. For individuals who may not be able to communicate vocally with us, whether or not the treatments we're using are acceptable, we'll look for other signs like emotional responding. If we're seeing a lot of crying, we're not going to continue with this intervention. We'll make changes. We also like to look at whether or not kids like coming into the building during the beginning of the day. Typically, we get they just love coming here and they're running into the building. They want to come play. That's what we want to see. So we'll look at signs like that, whatever we can capture that's going to show whether or not the child enjoys participating in the therapy. And then if you could actually go back a slide, there's some more misconceptions. There's a misconception that we're just drilling exercises at a table. There is one form of ABA that's called discrete trial training, where we're doing repeated practice. We're breaking down bigger skills into small steps to teach it in a repeated manner. It can be really helpful just to increase those learning opportunities for individuals, but we also do a lot of naturalistic teaching. So we will capture natural opportunities in the environment. Maybe if we're working on hand washing, great, you had a snack, or you're having a snack, let's wash your hands before that snack would be a good natural opportunity to work on that. So we do try to make them more naturalistic so that they are happening in other environments. Another misconception is that we seek to cure autism. There is no cure for autism, and frankly, ABA is not interested in finding one. It takes a variety of individuals to make this world work, and there's nothing inherently wrong with autism. Our goal is to improve the quality of life for our clients and their families. So we're going to be targeting behaviors that are dangerous to others or teaching communication skills that will help the individual get their needs met in the natural environment. We also are seeking, another misconception is that we seek to make individuals with autism seem neurotypical. That's not our goal. Like I said, we won't address behaviors that aren't interfering with their quality of life. So things like hand flapping, if that's not interrupting their ability to learn in the classroom, we're not going to work on it. If it is, we might work on, well, where are some times and places that that's okay to engage in the behavior so that you can participate in your classroom appropriately at other times to make sure they have those learning opportunities. Another misconception is that we use bribery with an ABA. We do use rewards, and I know rewards can sound a little scary to people, but if you think about it, we all have rewards. I show up to work because I get a paycheck. I'm not going to come to work if I'm not getting that paycheck. So we're trying to find rewards to put in place to get these behaviors going for individuals. We don't use bribery. So bribery, we consider if the individual is not doing something that we are wanting them to do, and then we kind of dangle the carrot in front of them, like, well, okay, if you go to the bathroom, you're going to get this treat afterwards. We try to not do it after the behavior is not occurring because that would be considered bribery. But maybe if you do eliminate in the toilet, we are going to give you a snack, but that happens every single time. Another misconception is that we rely on punishment and aversive procedures. We don't, and our ethical code actually forbids us from using any punishment procedures without thoroughly exhausting all of our other options first and getting opinions from other individuals in our field. So, why is ABA uniquely suited for individuals with autism or other developmental disabilities? Typically, these individuals may show a lack of response to typical instruction strategies. So, teachers in the classroom, their ratios, they've got a lot of students in their classroom. They may not be able to dedicate as much time to one individual student when they're trying to work with an entire class. Whereas we can really break it out down. We're one-on-one. We can give that repeated instruction that's necessary to get the behaviors going and then transfer it to the classroom. These individuals may also demonstrate an atypical developmental sequence. So if you think about development, we're often seeing kind of like building blocks where kids are gaining skills one after the other. They're sequentially coming and building on each other like blocks. With autism or other developmental disabilities, we may see skill gaps. So maybe they've got some more advanced skills and some really basic skills, but they're missing some of those skills in the middle. So we can really assess what are the skills that they have, what are the deficits that they have, and then focus our attention in filling in any of those gaps so that they can continue progressing. We may also see motivational difficulties. So sometimes individuals with autism may not be motivated by the same things others are. Maybe praise isn't as motivating for them as it would be for a neurotypical child. And that's not for everyone, that's just in some cases. But we can break it down and really find what is going to be motivating for this child and how can we put those factors in play so that they are engaging in behaviors that are going to improve their quality of life. We also can work with individuals who have a greater need for direct teaching of component skills. So, if we're teaching maybe shoe tying, maybe with a typically developing individual, you need to show them a few times. You can teach them all of the steps at the same time, but we might have to break it down into smaller steps for an individual with autism and really teach the components of that skill. They may also require more structured instruction or repeated practice with things. So, like I said, we're one-to-one, so we can really take the time and sit down and practice these skills over and over again to give them those increased learning opportunities. And then finally, they may have an increased need for tangible reinforcers. That's just rewards, things like toys to play with, after you complete work. Sometimes it can be edible, so like snacks. Like I said, maybe if you're going to the bathroom in the potty, then you're going to get a snack afterwards. They may have an increased need for those things. We always try to fade them out because we do want the behaviors to happen in the natural environment, even when those rewards are not in place, but they can be a really nice starting off point to get the behaviors going. And then I want to talk a little bit about, you can leave it on this one, about the services provided at the Center for Autism. So we do have a variety of clinics that work on decreasing problematic behaviors. I mentioned this a little bit. It's going to be things like decreasing challenging behaviors like aggression, self-injurious behavior, so like hitting themselves, We wouldn't consider problematic behaviors things like hand flapping or anything that's not interfering with their safety or the safety of others. Our clinics are also some that also work on increasing desirable communication and social skills, as well as adaptive skills. So that might be teaching individuals to ask for what they want if they don't have a means of communication. With social skills, maybe it is returning greetings if somebody greets you that you're saying hi back. Adaptive skills, we're looking at daily living skills. So can they dress themselves? Do they know how to wash their hands? Any of those skills that will improve quality of life. And we also have clinics designed to promote a successful transition to the workforce or to higher education. So we are fortunate we've got a couple really cool clinics, one that works with teenagers on job-related social skills. So things like, can you interview appropriately for a job? Can you accept feedback from a supervisor? Teaching those skills so individuals can obtain and maintain jobs. And we also have a connecting to college program for individuals enrolled in the university who do have an autism diagnosis. So that can provide supports for them, maybe in the classroom, social interactions, or even independent living. So things like, can you do your laundry? They can work on a variety of those skills.
So, and I know you're going to, but I think we need you to go deeper a little bit about the programs because you mentioned, some of these, I think often, and it's not always the case, but when people think of ABA therapy, we're thinking of toddlers and do it early and, kind of all the things that we've heard. But then, I've seen clients over the years, kind of a lifetime of ongoing therapy of different things. And so, can we talk about, I think a lot of us are familiar with the younger, the younger path of ABA, but about continuing services for older individuals on the spectrum, like you're talking about, like the workforce and higher education. So this program is for these older, adolescents or young adults. Is if they're enrolled in one of the programs at U of H. So can you just explain that a little bit more to us, please?
Yeah, so the one is our vocational program. That is the one designed for, I believe it starts at 15 and older, and there's no diagnostic requirement, but that is through the Texas Workforce Commission. So they have a lot of great other resources as well, but you would go through enrollment through the Texas Workforce Commission, and then they would refer you to our vocational program. But what the program itself does is they'll work with the family and with the individual to find out areas of interest for them that they want to work on. And they'll set up opportunities for them to practice implementing job skills. So I know some of the things they've worked on are if you get a task, but you aren't sure how to complete it, right? You need some clarification of how to complete that. Can you go find a supervisor and ask those clarifying questions? Or if you are getting feedback from a supervisor, can you accept that appropriately and then go implement that feedback? Would be some of the skills that they work on. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and just to piggyback on what you said, the VR program through the Workforce Commission, we have had webinars on that in the past. And all states, if you're, attending from another state, all states have vocational rehab programs, and it's services start as early as age 14, and it's for individuals who have a disability that is essentially an impediment to employment. So what you're saying is through the Texas Workforce Commission, if it's a part of their like employment plan, that this vocational program that is administered by U of H could be covered through VR, I think is what you were saying.
I believe so. I'm not, because the Texas Workforce Commission handles like the payment side of things, I think it is funded. So it would be a cost for the families, but I'm not 100% confident in that answer.
And to, yes, to Kim's point, most high schools do have a VR counselor. A lot of parents don't know that. So you can clearly go online and start My VR through the state of Texas. You can start My VR. But you can, and you can actually do that and then contact your local counselor. Your local counselor at the high school can help you apply. You can apply online and then reach out to the local counselor and let her know, him or her know that you have applied. But there is a lot of good resources out there. And now that school is back in session, you can definitely talk to your counseling department because they definitely know about VR.
And I did mention a little bit our connecting to college program too, but like I said, that program is for individuals enrolled in the university. So you would need to first enroll in the university as a student and get accepted. And then once you're there, that's a resource available to the current students. So a little bit about why we address the goals we do work on within ABA. I know I've harped on this a lot, but we are focusing on decreasing behaviors that are problematic and impeding the individual's safety, safety of others, or their ability to live with a high quality of life. And we want to increase desirable behaviors, behaviors that are desirable for the individual because they're getting their needs and wants met. And we do this by focusing on modifying the environment. So we are looking at how can we set them up with tools either before a behavior occurs to encourage them to engage in the desirable behaviors, or how are we looking at those rewards and what's happening after the behavior to increase the likelihood of the desirable behaviors and decrease the likelihood of the problematic behaviors. We do focus heavily on collaboration of care. So we require that caregivers participate in our programs. Some of the programs require that a caregiver is present for every single session, but they all require some level of caregiver participation. This is really important because, as I mentioned, they can do it in the clinic with us, and that's great, but it's not going to improve their quality of life if they're not able to also do it at home or in school. And we'll also work with teachers as well.
Now, I guess I'm curious about this for our older, adolescents or our young adults and the connecting to college. A big part of the connecting to college or big part of college is that growing independence. And even though, a lot of these young adults, maybe on the spectrum or have other disabilities, some of them actually live independently. And so they're, trying to do the adulting thing. They may be having some mishaps, but I guess we all did, right? But so is that really, if you got a 19 or 20-year-old that's in the connecting to college program, does their parent really need to be sitting there with them? Is that part of that?
I don't think that they have a caregiver participation requirement for that program.
Okay.
And what that might look like for older families, a lot of times it's managing caregiver expectations, or even teaching caregivers to provide their child with the opportunity to engage in some of these skills independently. So I would say that's more of what it looks like is, we can teach them to do their laundry, but you're going to need to give them the chance to do their laundry is kind of more where our caregiver training moves as individuals get older.
Well, and for the younger years, I guess it's more of understanding what's happening during the training, so that way a parent or a caregiver could be implementing these things at home in line of the skills that they were learning. So I get that as well. So, okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I know we finished pretty early, so I'm happy to take any questions that anyone has.
Well, and guys, please do put your questions in the chat box for us today. But tell us a little bit more about the program. Not everybody's kids are in VR. Maybe they're not in VR anymore, or what have you. Are these programs available for private pay for families? And tell us about the different doors that you can walk through for these programs, because you mentioned a few different programs. And like, is there a graduation of steps of these programs? And if I want to private pay for this program, can I do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we kind of have, I know I talked about vocational and connecting to college and how you would get enrolled in those. Those two are kind of separate from the rest of our programs. They are more for older individuals, and the enrollment process for that's going to be different. So just to reiterate that, the vocational program would be going through the Texas Workforce Commission, and then connecting to college would be you're already enrolled as a student, and then we have an interest form that you could fill out. To express interest in that resource that's available for students. The rest of our programs is kind of more of the actual Center for Autism and Developmental Disabilities. And for those, there is, I know my contact information is on here and I can get anybody set up with our initial questionnaire. We have an initial questionnaire on our website and we can help you find which clinics are going to be the best fit for your child. We do have children who go through all of the clinics, so you're welcome to receive services through as many of them as you're interested in. We can kind of set it up to be a nice transition where maybe you start in a more intensive one and then we're fading out over time. But I can walk you through each of those programs as well. So we have a connecting the dots program, which works on decreasing challenging behaviors and increasing communication skills for individuals. I believe it's 2 to 18 with an autism diagnosis. That one, there is a grant-funded program, so there's no cost for families for those services. It is a short-term program, so it is an 8-week training program for caregivers. So the caregiver and their child would participate in the sessions, so that we can give the caregiver the tools to continue practicing these skills after their time in the clinic. Because, like I said, it's 8 weeks; it moves pretty quickly. We're not going to see all the progress we would like to see within that 8-week period. We also have an ABA SKIP program. That is a focus intervention program. So we'll pick about 3 to 4 goals that caregivers would like to work on. That is for children 3 to 15 years old, 3 through 15 years old. And that one is for families that don't have access to ABA therapy through their insurance provider. So that might be families who don't have any insurance, their insurance doesn't cover ABA. Right now, that's still including families on Medicaid. I know Medicaid is now covering ABA in Texas, but it is still really challenging to find resources for that. So Medicaid still falls under the branch right now, too. And that
What was the
program,
name? Did you say skits? What the second part, ABA?
ABA SKIP, SKIP, SKIP. And I
Got
do
it.
have a
Thank you.
flyer on these programs I could provide if you want to send that out to participants as
Yeah,
well.
if you'll send that to us, I'll send
Yeah.
that out to all of the participants when we send the email with the slide and the slides and the recording. I would love to send that flyer as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. We also have and the ABA SKIP program goes for about 7 to 8 months. So that's a little bit of a longer term program where kids are coming in twice a week for about that 7 to 8 month period. We also have a verbal behavior clinic that sees clients once a week for 2 hours, and they work on increasing communication skills or social skills. That one's for about 15 weeks, and that clinic is private pay, but they do have a sliding fee based on family income size. So I think their base rate is $50 per hour. And like I said, it's 2 hour sessions, but then they do have that sliding fee scale. And then the last couple we have are a couple of clinics for decreasing problematic behaviors. So we have a severe behavior clinic that can work on decreasing any challenging behavior. So, like I mentioned, aggression towards others, aggression towards themselves. They see clients once a week for 15 weeks, and they are either private pay or they're also funded through the same state funding as the ABA SKIP program. So, if a family doesn't have access to ABA through their private insurance, they could receive services for free through that program.
And is this a 2 hour,
Yes.
2 hour one day
Yeah.
per week?
That one's a
Okay.
2 hour one a week as well.
And then, could you mention the age categories on this one as well, please?
That one does not have an age requirement. And then the last one also does not have an age requirement. It's our intensive outpatient program. That one does require an autism diagnosis, and it is grant funded, so it's free for families. There's no cost. And they are a intensive 2-week training program. So they see families for 40 hours a week for a 2-week period. They do require caregivers participate in the entire 2 weeks. They can provide any work excusal letters or anything that's necessary to help make that happen for families. But because it's a short-term program, they are also aiming to teach parents the skills to manage these behaviors after their time in the program.
Now, one question that I wanted to ask, just in case, not to put you on the spot or anything, but do you guys do any testing? Because, I hear a lot of families have their diagnosis, but then we have, families that have kids that are suspected, but they're not tested yet, and then they call around and they're given, being told 6 months, 9 months, a year for testing and stuff like that. Do you guys have any grants for testing or anything like that?
Yeah, we do not. Our psychological services department on campus does do some testing. And then I have a list of providers in the Houston area that do diagnostic evaluations that I'm happy to send to you as well, in case I know the wait lists are really long, so there might be some additional resources on there.
That's a wonderful idea. We would love to have that list as
Absolutely.
well. Some of them are just so long as whether or not they take insurance or not, and some of those other the moving parts that we know that time is of the essence. So the sooner we could actually have the diagnosis and get started on some of these various therapies and things like that the better. So I know it
Absolutely.
causes a great deal of stress to some parents, when they can't even actually get the diagnosis. And so, I know that, we talked about early childhood and ABA therapies and things like that. Could you just hit the highlights a little bit further on, is there a best practice? So if we have teenagers, if we're in high school, if we're in junior high, we're getting there. We're trying to get where we're going. Our brains aren't even fully formed until we're 26. We're not quite there yet. We're hopeful and optimistic. We need a little help. Do you have any tips and suggestions for families that maybe might be past the early childhood phase and are thinking about what's next?
Yeah, I think it's challenging to plan for that transition, and unfortunately, there's not a lot of resources available. So I think the schools do offer some resources. So I know it seems really young to start planning when your child's in like middle school, but I would start talking about that plan as early as possible, so that you can take the appropriate steps. There are some other resources in the community offhand. I think it's Houston Community College has a vast academy that they've got some great resources over there. I'm trying to
We've done
remember.
a webinar that lives on our
Okay.
YouTube channel. So if you've never heard of, if you're here with us today and you've never heard of HCC and the VAST Academy, we have definitely done a webinar with them in the past. And we also have webinars, complete webinars for basically college planning or higher education for individuals with a disability and programs all across the state of Texas. So you can check that out on the Consolidated Planning Group YouTube channel. There's over 300 webinars out there, but we really try to title them intelligently so you can scroll through and kind of see what you want. So you can pick on that. So that is really good. So we do have a person that said, I have a question. Is this ABA program qualifying for kids with Down syndrome, or just specifically only for autism? And that kind of begs the question too, of, we've got kids that are ADHD, and sometimes they have mannerisms that appear to be that maybe that level one on the spectrum that you were talking about. So, where do families that fall into that category, but maybe don't have the diagnostic criteria of autism, where do they go?
That's a really good question. So for our clinics, it depends on the clinic what the eligibility requirements are. And the only reason for that is just based on the funding source. So some funding sources are only providing for individuals who have an autism diagnosis. But for the clinics that don't have any diagnostic requirement, would be that vocational program does not, the verbal behavior clinic does not have a diagnostic requirement. They can work with any individual, as well as the severe behavior clinic. They can also work with any individual. So those are the three resources that we have that are available to anyone, Down syndrome, or even if they don't have any diagnoses. But there's still some issues that the caregivers would like to work on.
So it sounds like there's a variety of the things that you guys are doing that could kind of ebb and flow for other diagnoses as well. So basically, what my suggestion would be is to definitely check out their website. Consider a tour. I'm assuming that you guys have tours and they can kind of get a feel for what you guys are doing and kind of see things for themselves. How does that work? And furthermore, let's say we have people that are interested in this. Are you guys on a waiting list, or what's the turnaround time on that?
Yeah, we do have a wait list. The best way to get in touch with us is just to either reach out or complete that initial questionnaire, and then we will get in touch with you about like potential programs that would be a good fit. We can schedule a tour if you want to come in and see the clinic. In terms of wait lists, our Connecting the Dots program has the shortest wait list because it is a really fast-paced program. It's only 8 weeks, so families are moving through that pretty quickly. That one's about 3 to 6 months long. our ABA SCIP and Verbal Behavior Clinic. Those wait lists are going to be about 2 years long. They're longer term programs, so they're longer wait lists. The Severe Behavior Clinic is about 6 months to a year, and then the Intensive Outpatient Program is about 6 to 9 months. I can't
And
speak to the
for a
vocational.
parent that needs help now, that sounds like really far away, right? But one thing that I would say is, being, in Texas, we do have a lot of other much more resources than what a lot of other states have to begin with. But one of the key things that I like to mention is planning early, like we were talking about earlier. And that's just the same thing. If it's transition planning, if it's higher education, if you're going to stay in the public school till age 22, planning early, because even like residential programs or transition programs post high school, some of those have waiting lists too. Some of them require that you do a tour first to get your name on the waiting list. And what you don't want to do is be at this point where we're transitioning and then you see, oh snap, there's a 2 year waiting list, right? So I think, I think that that's important. And also with your referral list as well, there may be there's a tremendous amount of resources across the state of Texas, not just in the greater Houston area. The other things that you can be doing while you're getting where you're going as far as being on some of these lists as well, for sure.
And then, like I mentioned, our clinics, you don't have to pick just one. So families could receive services through multiple. So it kind of works out nicely. A lot of times they'll be able to start out in that Connecting the Dots program earlier. And then by the time they're wrapping up with that, there's some availability in one of the other clinics. And we can collaborate together and transition those programs over and kind of walk them through all of our clinics.
Now, is also if the person is in VR and this is part of their employment plan or whatever, is there a priority or may a person get in faster if they're coming through the VR door? Just out of curiosity.
I can't speak to that because all of the families would be coming through the Texas Workforce Commission and they manage the waitlist aspect of that. So I'm not too sure how that process works.
Okay, thank you. Kim, I want to just defer to you for a second because I know that you have a wealth of information too. Is there anything that you would like to share or add to our conversation today?
Absolutely. Well, so for the connecting to college and the vocational program, those are definitely for older students. You want to make sure that you are connecting while in school to your vocational rehab services. And so they will, there are a slew of providers that they work with, but then also asking and communicating with your provider and asking about these programs, then they can provide that funding and start that process with those programs within CAD. Back to what we were discussing the at the younger ages and not waiting. Some of these services or even similar services can come through your local provider for intellectual and developmental disabilities, your what we call LIDA, used to be MHMR. And so it's important for families to be also reaching out and making sure that they have connected with, if you live in Harris County, you need to connect with the Harris Center. And you need to make sure that you have added your child's name to the what we call the waiver lists, the interest lists. Those are years long. There's HCS and Texas Home Living and CLASS. Just calling them, the Harris Center for IDD, they will immediately walk you through that process. But then you also want to make sure you have completed intake, actually going to meet with them and complete that intake appointment. There are general revenue services. And one of those, so like the ABA SCIP program, and Tessa, correct me if something's changed, but my understanding is that's something that may be funded possibly through those general revenue or through the waiver services.
I think
So
that it used to be, but our funding sources have changed. So right
it
now it's
has
a
changed.
state,
Okay.
yeah, it's a state-funded program, and we're partnering with the Texana Center.
Oh, okay. So then they just go through your waitlist and your process for that. Wonderful.
Texana is the LIDA for Fort Bend County. But one thing I wanted to mention to your point on those waiver interest lists, because sometimes we have people on here and it says, wait a minute, what are they even talking about?
What is
a lot
that?
Of people, their kids are already on the list. Some people are getting a waiver. We do have a complete webinar on all of the Medicaid waivers in Texas. And in on that webinar, in those slides, it tells you exactly who and where, what to do, how to get on those lists, and what each one of those waivers is seeking to do. But in general, those Medicaid waivers are designed to waive off some of the cost of care for caring for an individual who has a disability. And the point of it is to keep them in home and community-based services and out of being institutionalized. That's the point of it. And so they, what they do is they pay for things like therapy, attendance services, respite services, various programs. Like they pay for different things. Which sounds delightful, and you're probably thinking, if you're not signed up, great, I'm signing up for that. But the bad news is in Texas, there's about a 17-year waiting list, and so it's not quick. It's not a quick fix. You sign up, and then you're going to get this. It's a very, very slow process, but that is why it is so critically important that you go ahead and get your child on the list now, and there are such things as fast-tracking if in crisis, and that's a whole other ballgame, but we talk about that on that. On that webinar. So I just wanted to do a sidebar on that for anybody that was here that isn't really sure what you're talking about when you say the waivers or the interest list.
Yes, yes. Money for services and a long wait. And so that's what I would recommend, is that early on is that you're making sure to get on those waiver lists, then you are completing that. And then when we become older and we are looking at post, you know, after high school, 14 and up is for vocational rehab. And that's definitely, you can also reach out to your local, your high school. There should be a transition vocational counselor assigned to every high school. And so that's a way to make that connection with vocational rehab services.
Okay. I lost my, one thing that I would like to say is that I think that it is also important. I just want to mention, because sometimes we have people that talk about, they're frustrated with the vocational rehab, and they haven't seen, they don't have any response, or they're not getting what they need and all that kind of thing. Don't give up. I just wanted to provide some encouragement to not give up. If you have had a frustrating experience, they have struggled to keep staff since COVID. And so that it has been difficult, but don't give up, because they have state and federally funded dollars, big pockets, and our kids need their help. So you can private pay for these things if you want to, or you can work with vocational rehab. And if your child is older than 22, there are adult services as well as the, as adolescent services. So just be aware that those services are available to you as well. And just get started with those. There's not a long waiting list to get going with the vocational rehab programs. And there are such things, you know, they work with Texas Workforce Solutions, Texas Workforce Commission. Our kids could have a job coach. They have summer earn and learn. When your students are still in high school, they have summer earn and learn, pre-employment training services. There's a lot of services out there. You do have to put your patient's hat on, because it is a government entity that you're working with, and it's not always as fast as parents would like. But do be patient. And the thing is if you need to say next, if you need to ask for a supervisor with Workforce Commission and get your case reassigned because maybe your counselor is overloaded and is not getting back to you, or things aren't moving, then don't be afraid to move that bar and kind of get things moving along that way. But be encouraged, and just simply knowing that there are a lot of resources out there, and they're not all costing you thousands of dollars out of pocket. It's a matter of plugging in. There are requirements for caregiver plug-in and training and other things like that, but it's not egregious. It's not anything that you haven't been doing all of your child's life to begin with. Part of the VR, the student has to want to be doing it. they have to have some skin in the game and they have to be willing to participate. So we've seen people in our practice where, like, the mom really wants their kid to do VR and the kid has zero interest and the kid does nothing that they're supposed to do. Well, they're not going to get to stay in VR in those examples. But you know, 2 or 4 years from now, the kid might be a little bit more mature and might be willing to do things that they weren't willing to do previous, and that nothing stops you from coming back to VR in that regard as well. So from a perspective, I always, in a link to our slides, when you get our slides, you're going to have a link to the upcoming webinars that we have coming up. And then, of course, a link to our YouTube channel, as well as kind of an introduction of the members of our team. We work on a collaborative team here at CPG, and you're going to have the contact information basically for the program as well. And again, if you are attending today and kind of hearing this podcast and you want a copy of today's slides, you can email us at contact at cpgcares.net, and we will simply send you a copy of today's slides as well. It has certainly been my pleasure being here with both of you. There's been some good questions and good conversation in the chat box. And so you guys can just watch out for your email, and we will get that. Let me do that right now. So it's contact for CPG Cares. Let me make sure I've got that. Bear with me 1 second. I'm going to put that contact@cpgcares.net. So it's out there in the chat box for everyone. Tessa, it was simply our pleasure. You did a great job talking about those programs. And I know Kim keeps her ear to the ground. I keep my ear to the ground, and I didn't know about these programs. So I'm excited to learn something new today. Thanks, everyone, for spending the hour with us. We appreciate it. And feel free to reach out. Go take your tour for some of these programs and learn a little bit more of them. Thank you again, Kim, for your time. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Thank you.